now.
Guys, my name is Bob Davis. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to start with a short prayer. Lord, I ask that you set aside everything I know about you, everything I know about me, everything I know about my own recovery, and everything I know about my fellows, so that I might have a new experience, Lord, a new experience in you, a new experience in me, a new experience in my fellows, and a much, much needed new experience in my recovery. And, you know, there's one thing about screwed up about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that it's full of alcoholics. You know, I wanted to spend a few minutes this morning talking about something that I mean, incredibly dear to me. And probably in this group it'll go over better than it would in the normal home group. Because anytime you start mentioning things about unity or tradition or things like that, people go, oh my God, not again. You know, it's funny, I was taught by people who revered the traditions and the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it still took me a few years to really get interested and engaged in the history of the program. And, you know, and probably everybody, most everybody here has a pretty good version of the history, but I do want to just kind of talk a few minutes about it. And, you know, some of the things I'm not as learned as Don and some others on the history, but, you know, I love it. And, you know, I find it interesting that long before Alcoholics Anonymous was born in 1935, that somewhere around 1912 or 13, there were four families that took a summer vacation in the Northeast, and those four families didn't know each other, but they went on a vacation separately, coincidentally, unquote. Those four people were the Hazard family, the Thatcher family, the Wilson family, and the Burnham family. And you know, Ebby and Roland and Bill and Lois all started to become friends as teenagers. And they would return there every summer, and they became friends. And over the years, that chance meeting in 1912 or 13 laid a foundation for friendships that were to later build Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I didn't know that when I think Joe and Charlie, I think, was the first people that mentioned that. And many years ago, when those old cranky old goats used to drag me all over the country to hear these two old guys talk. And over the years, I probably saw them 12 or 15 different times. We became great friends. And I was blessed to be in their presence many, many times and sit around coffee tables in the middle of the night and listen to those guys tell stories, you know, about stuff that I couldn't imagine people talking about to start with, but, you know, that were hilarious and sad, but, you know, were all a part of their recovery and kind of the building of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, so those four families get together and they continue to get together and later, you know, Roland and Carl Jung, you know, spend some time together and he tries to instill in Roland this idea of recovery, you know, in a spiritual basis, which was, you know, quite unusual between Atkins and Freud and Carl Jung. Carl Jung was the only one who believed that there was a spiritual angle to any of this. So if it had happened like they wanted it to, which is Roland would have went to Sigmund Freud, who was too busy, or Atkins, who was too busy, he couldn't go there, so he ended up with Carl Jung. Another coincidence, so to speak, you know, where he began to learn of this, you know, this vital spiritual experience that was necessary. And, you know, so Bill has his experience in Towns Hospital in, what, late 1934, and he goes out and he tries to help. The number I've heard most is 96, but somewhere in the 90s of guys that Bill tried to help and was completely 100% unsuccessful. You know, so he ends up in Akron on a business deal that completely falls apart. He's walking in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, which I have paced that lobby, I don't know, half a dozen times over the years. I've called my sponsor from that phone that used to be in the lobby, it's no longer there. But you know, he's pacing this lobby, and he's, you know, there's a bar at one end of the lobby, and you hear the clinking of glasses and the camaraderie that's going on and the fellowship in the bar. And he's trying to decide what he's going to do because he doesn't have any money even to pay the hotel bill. You know, and he decides that he knew that helping other alcoholics had kept him sober for 6 months, even though none of them had recovered. None of them had gotten that message. So, you know, he makes a phone call. And he ends up calling, you know, probably the first non-treated member of Al-Anon, Henrietta Stiberling. And she's got a doctor for her. She wants her help. And you know, they call Ann Smith that night, and Ann says, no, I don't think he can do much tonight because he's potted under the kitchen table, you know, because he'd already had a couple fists. And Dr. Bob was in there. And the whole next day, she badgers and berates him about going to meet this guy. I'm not going to meet any old Yankee to tell me about my drinking and yada, yada. And finally, you know, he says, I'll give him 15 minutes. You know, and they head over to the gatehouse at the Cyberman Mansion. You know, Bob walks in and begins to talk to Bill for 15 minutes. And 5 hours, 6 hours later, he's coming out. And what he's saying is, this is the only guy that I have ever talked to that knows what he's talking about. You know, and in the interim, Bill had talked to Silkworth, and Silkworth said, you know, well, just don't lead with God. Lead with your story. You know, lead with your drinking. Because that, you know, the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, when one alcoholic sits down with another, and we begin to tell stories, and A is about all about stories. It's just about stories. And I begin to talk to you about my story. And somewhere in there, there's a connection that's made. It's not mainly because I'm smart. It's not made because I know more than anybody else. It's made because I discuss something that you have an experience with. You know, the loneliness, the despair, you know, that I experienced through continued drinking. You know, that I can no longer escape no matter how much I drink. You know, and he has this conversation with Bob, and Bob didn't get sober right then. You know, he decided to further his business and everything. He needed to go to a convention in Atlantic City. After about 30 days, and he went, and he got drunk, and he came back, and they poured him out of the train, and you know, they called his secretary, and she came down, and they loaded him up, and you know, Bill was still there. And you know, they had a conversation. And somewhere during the day, they realized it was June 10th. And Bob says, oh my God, I've got surgery. Now, Bob was a proctologist, so, you know, he's going to have to do the surgery. So Bill actually gives him his last couple drinks, you know, to steady him up. And I don't know that I've ever read where they figured out who this guy was that he performed surgery on them. They did figure out, however, that the guy lived. Now, he may have whistled when he walked. we don't really know, and, this is where he lived. And then Bob disappears, and he's, you know, he drank initially again because he hadn't done an eighth and ninth step, even though they didn't exist at the time. I mean, they existed in the Oxford groups, but you know, he spent the whole day and the whole night going around talking to people that he felt like he owed, whether money or amends or some other kind of thing. And he came back and he never drank again. You know, and so AA begins to grow, and it grows very slowly. And you know, there were a number of things historically that really propelled that growth. One was, you know, there was an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer about a baseball player, you know, who had gotten sober and touted the advantages of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of recovery that was existed at that time.
Oh, yes.
You know, there was a Liberty Magazine article, which, you know, also had an effect, but much less so because it also led with God. You know, that article was much more down a religious tangent than a spiritual tangent. But then there was this other guy that really blew AA up for in a manner of speaking. And, you know, his name was Jack Alexander, and Jack was a well-known investigative reporter. He was a straight shooter. He just always got to the bottom line on everything. You couldn't buy him off. So you knew when he wrote something that it was real and it was accurate. And he writes this article on Saturday in the Post in December 1941 that changed the age drastically. You know, it began to blow up and get into, you know, spread across the country, began to spread. And coming with that were a lot of problems, you know, and problems that we hadn't dealt with before because they're brand new. You know, problems which really revolved around disunity. You know, rules and regulations and you know, requirements. And, you know, there was a woman, I forget her name, in California, and they got, you know, excommunicated from Alcoholics Anonymous because she liked men. She liked men. But, I mean, there's a lot of women that I've seen and, you know, that liked men that helped an awful lot of people. You know, you think about Sybil. When she first started, you know, one of the first sober women in Alcoholics Anonymous who, you know, as story has it, would be started helping people 2 days sober because there were no other women, you know. But Bill continued to get over and over, continued to get letters from people from all over the place that, you know, we're having this problem and that problem. And it became obvious that Alcoholics Anonymous needed some kind of guidelines in order to manage the growth and to manage the intricacies of group dynamics and things like that. So he began to write originally the long form of the tradition, you know, which was the first thing that he wrote. And he began to try selling these things to Alcoholics Anonymous across the country. And nobody wanted to hear about the traditions then. They still don't want to hear about them now. In fact, there are letters that I've seen and read from the archives that show Bill being invited. And he was certainly the most invited speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. But he would be invited many times to speak at some conference or engagement or meeting. But there was a stipulation in the request. The request was, we'd love for you to come and talk if you promise not to talk about the tradition. You know, so as it went along, even that, you know, the office was encouraging him to write something a little shorter. You know, what we read a lot of times in meetings now. I mean, when I got sober, you know, we read How It Works and Traditions, and that was it. You know, we said a Serenity Prayer and a Lord's Prayer. There's not all this other reading that we do now, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. We'll talk a little bit about opinions if I get time, but because I got lots of opinions. You know, and the traditions eventually tell me that I'll just keep my mouth shut. You know, that I am one vote among many. No more important or less important. But so he starts. And I like to always refer to the book so I don't get anything wrong. But, you know, that our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon A, unity. And I'm just going to talk about a couple of these, three or four, because not that any is more important or less important than the other. There's some interesting things I thought. But, you know, the long form is each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. A must continue to live or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare comes first, but individual welfare follows close afterwards. So, you know, I must subjugate myself to the greater good, you know, and to the good of the group. And the unity, while it's mentioned in the first tradition, it's, you know, it's, again, my opinion, but I think every other of the remaining 11 traditions all support the first tradition. You know, each one of the remainder of the traditions is in support of the unity that's called out in the first tradition. Because together, we can do lots of things. Individually, I'm no good. I'm no good by myself. I have to have you. You know, if I'm left to my own devices, without my group, or without my sponsor, or without sponsees, without the program of recovery, then I'm eventually going to drink again, because I'm a real alcoholic. You know, I am the real deal. And I'm not sure sometimes whether that's good or bad, but I mean, it's good that I know. You know, and I must continue to support that unity by my active participation, but not more than that. You know, I know, and I think for, when you stay around Alcoholics Anonymous a long time, whether warranted or not, you get some level of respect that sometimes places me in a position of arrogance. You know, that I know more than anybody else, or I have all the answers. And, you know, I mean, thank God for the people that I've been around who are incredibly good at pounding me over the head and reminding me that while you are important, just as important as everybody else, you know, more important, you know, that you're one voice, and that voice needs to be, you know, toward that unity. And I don't know, I spent about 10, 12 years in the service structure of AA as, you know, alternate GSR and GSR and alternate DCM and DCM, and served on state committees for a number of years. And you know, one of the things that I saw there, and I've seen it in a less sizable way in a group, but, you know, the power of the group conscience, the unity of the group conscience is an amazing thing to see. You know, I've been in state meetings where probably 600 GSR members there. And there was an issue that came up to which the final vote was 598-2. And those two people stood up as a minority opinion, and they expressed their opinion and why they had that opinion. And to watch a room of that size completely flip on its head because of one or two people who have a different opinion is something that's incredibly amazing. You don't see that in business. The guy with the biggest hammer wins every battle. You know, the guy with the biggest office wins the battle. He makes the decision. Very seldom do you see what is, you know, termed servant leadership in a for-profit business. At least that's my experience. And in AA, you see it all the time. I see it all the time. That one newcomer who's been sober about 13 seconds has an idea or an opinion that can sway a group of people that have been sober half their lives. You know, and the fact that we have enough unity in that process to listen, to me, is an amazing thing. Because I don't know about you, but I didn't listen to anybody when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't listen to anybody because you're stupid. You know, that was a given. And I'm smarter than you. And I didn't listen to anybody. And that, among other things in the program, has taught me, and we said it last night in our small group, that the two greatest things that God has ever given me is my time and my attention. You know, my attention to listen, my time to give to someone else, my time to be focused on how I might help you instead of what you might give me. You know, you become, this unity helps you become a giver instead of a taker, because I've been a taker my whole life. You know, so unity, you know, becomes incredibly important. You know, for our group purpose, there's only one authority, loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience, our leadership, our servants that do not govern. And, you know, this is the only tradition where the long form is actually shorter than the short form. Mm-hmm. Who could do that but an alcoholic? And for our group purpose, there's one ultimate authority, loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. And I think, you know, Bill probably added that in the short form after the fact, when he saw that, you know, we have a lot of leaders, so-called leaders, that like to control, you know, that like to dictate what the group is going to do. And I've seen it happen, you know, and it drives me crazy. I mean, I started a meeting in February. It's a line-by-line big book study. And I started it. It was, you know, my idea, but there were others who shared the idea. But somehow it's got to be a Bob Davis meeting. Hmm. And it really drives me nuts because it isn't. You know, it's a meeting that we all put on together, a bunch of us. And, you know, I don't want that. It's like, you know, and when I got sober, we didn't have speaker discussion meetings. They didn't exist. You know, because, and I think they knew that because it turns into a speaker for half an hour and then 30 minutes of the audience telling the speaker how wonderful they are. You know, which is really uncomfortable and you know, it is disunity. You know, it makes me special. And I'm not special. You know, I'm just an average guy just like each one of you. And again, the whole unity idea of putting me on the same playing field level with everyone else. I don't know about you, but I came here one or two places better than you or worse than you. Most of the time, worse than you. And alcoholics and arms allows me to be the same as you. I mean, we may experience different things. We may have different troubles or success at different times. But essentially, at a base level, we're all the same. You know, we're all the same. I'm an alcoholic trying to get sober by using a set of spiritual principles and practicing them in my life. You know, the success of that depends on how well I do that, how thorough I am in doing that, how honest I am in doing that. You know, the book tells me nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. Then it counts here just as well as it is here. I meant to say in the beginning that often, almost always, I hear people, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, say that, you know, the steps are for the individual and the traditions are for the group. And I just don't, that's not true in my life. The fact of the matter is the traditions actually govern my behavior more than steps. I mean, if I look at them, they all govern my behavior in Alcoholics Anonymous and outside. You know, they teach me about humility. They teach me about how I should interact in my life. You know, because when I get here, the primary thing that I fail to recognize is my total inability to have a lasting relationship with another human being. These ideas and the traditions help me, again, to be able to have those relationships, you know, because I'm no longer, you know, above you. I'm no longer below you. I'm on the same level as you. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I think there are a couple places in here, from my opinion, the long form actually is much better than the short form. The long form of the third tradition is our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover, nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group, they have no other affiliation, and it talks much about affiliation later, but, you know, I think, sorry, I'm breaking the tradition about expressing no opinions, but please excuse me. You know, I think that today, and I heard Charlie Parmley say this many years ago, and this is long, you know, back in probably the 80s, and at that time, he said probably 40% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous come here and they're not real alcoholics. And I would tend to agree that that's probably higher than that now. I mean, because if I trip over the kid's toy in the backyard after having a drink, they ship me off to treatment. You know, or, you know, God forbid I get a DUI, I'm definitely going to treatment. You know, and a lot of times I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, the book talks about, you know, moderate drinkers and heavy drinkers and hard drinkers, and then talks about the real alcoholic. And, you know, I think it's on, you know, 20, 21, and you may have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have a habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. And he caused him to die a few years before his time. But if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop and moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may need some medical attention. So, you know, the third tradition, short form, and this people have just as much right to be here as I do if they haven't started, stopped drinking. But they actually don't have to do what I have to do to stay sober. They don't have to do that. I see people all the time, and not judging at all, but I mean, they don't have to work the steps to stay sober. I don't know how they do it. They're not like me. You know, I tried that and wanted to kill myself. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober, wanted to kill myself. And, you know, so I try to pay particular attention to the guys I sponsor and to find out where they are on the spectrum, because, you know, I want you to stay, but you need to get the help you need, and it may not, that may not be it, you know. So I don't have any trouble diagnosing myself, and most people don't if they're honest. But you know, the tradition says, if you want to stop drinking, you're welcome here. But I do need to realize that there is a difference between the heavy drinker or the hard drinker and the real alcoholic. And because the real alcoholic, I think as I said last night, suffers from a physical allergy to alcohol. That once I ingest any alcohol, I can't stop. You know, when I can't stop, there's no telling where it might end up. And so I want to skip over just... I'm going to skip to tradition 8. You know that Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. And the law form is Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. And we define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholic for fees or hire. But we may employ alcoholics where they're going to perform those services for which we might otherwise have to engage non-alcoholics. Such special services may be well recompensed, but our usual AA 12-step work is never paid for. And I'm not one who ever got into alcoholism treatment, counseling. I know I have a lot of friends who do. And I know a lot. Keith Lewis was a sponsor of mine for quite a while, and Keith operated in that area, in that arena for many, many years, and did it very successfully. But, you know, there are a lot of people who do that and don't stay sober. In fact, there was an article I read quite a while ago that if you looked at the occupations of those who relapse in Alcoholics Anonymous, the number one occupation for relapse in AA was alcoholism counselor, which seems a little odd, but it was. You know, and because it's difficult sometimes to separate this from free and for fun. You know, when I stop doing this for free and for fun, I'm in trouble. I'm in deep, deep trouble, because I can't and you can't swing a dead cat around here in South Florida without hitting a sober coach or, you know, somebody doing that. You know, and if you can do that, I guess it's okay, but I can't. You know, I was taught this is for free and for fun. At the moment I put any monetary value on it, then I'm dead. You know, I'm dead. And the funny thing about, you know, doing for others, and you know, I mean, I talk a lot about it because it's important to me, is, you know, the giving to others. And if my sponsor in the beginning, she said, you know, and many of us have gotten this edict, you go out every day and you help somebody. You do something for somebody, and you don't stand around and wait for a thank you or a pat on the back or a handshake or $5. You just do it and walk away. And I remember the first time I did that, and I happened to be in a position to see the individual that I had done something for, recognized that someone had done something for them. And I don't know, I put a woman in the office, wanted some paper, and I got her some paper, and just dropped it on her desk and walked away. And it was not intentional, but I just happened to be somewhere when I saw her walk back up to her desk, and she realized somebody had got her some paper, and she didn't know who. And there was a look on her face that transferred to my heart that I've never forgotten. You know, and that feeling was the spiritual value that is included in that act of kindness. Now, the moment that I stand there and say, oh, by the way, I want to make sure you know I did that, it loses all spiritual value. I mean, the spiritual value that I gain is completely disintegrates in light of me wanting credit. You know, and so I don't want credit. You know, I do like to see the reaction, you know, when it's possible. I mean, I look for it, but occasionally you see it. And it just, you know, it reinforces the value of helping God's kids. You know, and it doesn't matter whether it's a woman at work or, you know, somebody at the grocery store or somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it doesn't matter because, you know, it works equally well no matter who it is. You know, and what a change that is in you know, the fact that I'm becoming unified with this program and this fellowship, and I'm adopting some of the practices and principles that we talk about in my life, and I'm the one that benefits. You know, it's like doing something like this. Yeah, I mean, I love to talk, and Mark and everybody knows I love to talk, particularly about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll guarantee I get more benefit out of this than anybody in this room. Guaranteed. I mean, I'll leave here, you know, I won't even have to drive. I'll float. And not because of anything I said or did, but because I've spent a weekend with a bunch of guys who are focused on sobriety, focused on building a relationship with God, focused on being good fathers and friends and employees and employers and members of AA. You know, they're focused on practicing these principles in their lives. You know, and particularly the principles of the traditions, which really all revolve around unity and humility. And, you know, I love the last three traditions in particular. I love a lot. Nine is, A is such, I'll never be organized, but we may create service for. Now, have you ever seen a group of people that would be less organized than us? I mean, you got to be kidding. Get a bunch of alcoholics together and try to think they'd be organized. We're not. You know, but we are the most unorganized group of people I've ever seen. You know, stuff just magically happens. You know, you get a bunch of people in a room, they're trying to figure something out, and somehow, some way, it gets figured out. Mm-hmm. You know, and most of the time it's because somebody got down on their knees and said, God, we need some help. Mm-hmm. You know, could you give me an intuitive thought? Could you send me somebody with an answer? Mm-hmm. Could you give me some ideas on how we might solve this problem? And then inevitably, the problem gets solved. You know, and a lot of times it gets solved because we all go somewhere and help somebody else. And when I get back, the problem's gone. You know, that's the amazing thing. The book over and over tells me, again, the answer to your problem is go help somebody. My sponsor is just makes you want to vomit, he says so much. You know, what are you doing? You know, and all my sponsors over the years, and I've had 10, eight of them have died without my permission. But they all ask the same question. What are you doing? You know, they'd say, what are you doing? And I'd start telling them how I'm feeling. And they said, I don't give a damn how you feel. What are you doing? You know, how many meetings are you going to? What service work are you doing? How many guys have you sponsored? You know, what are you doing? What are your feet doing? You know, because your feet determine what the outcome will be. Talk with your feet. You know, so they continue to do that. You know, and they continue to do that, and it still works because the book over and over again tells me the answer to my question is go help somebody else. Go focus your attention somewhere other than yourself, which is really hard because I'm pretty important. You know, it's hard to get it off of me. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about a lot of days. And, you know, and this, over the course of the last 2 years, I think this is probably, you know, been something I've talked to more people about related to the traditions than anything else. And, you know, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion, meaning to always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And you know, with the advent of social media and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, there was an article that Dr. Bob wrote, or a letter, back in the 40s, that addressed the 11th tradition. And I would point out, which was pointed out to me, I didn't come up with it, but the tradition says at the level of press radio, exactly at that level. So his letter basically paraphrased said, you know, to maintain my anonymity above the level of press, radio, and film is proper. It's appropriate. You should do it. To maintain it at a level below the level of press, radio, and film is a break of the tradition.
Absolutely.
You know, I should, you know, the A group pamphlet used to say, it's been rewritten. It says it in different words now, but, you know, within AA, we exchange full names freely. Mm-hmm. You know, where I grew up, everybody used their full name. When I moved to Florida back in 2011 and then again in 2017, nobody used their last name. I mean, I was like an anomaly. They laugh, I'm Davis. You know, they love to do that because I mean, I was the only one. And, you know, I tell you, it's, to me, it's very important because I can tell you that at least on maybe 10 different occasions, I went to the hospital looking for somebody, and I go up to the counter and I go, "Hey, is Bob here?" I'm like, "Bob, who?" I'm like, "Oh, blonde haired Bob with glasses." She's like, "Sir, I don't know who you're talking about. Are you drinking?"
But today.
Yeah. So it's important for people to know me in Alcoholics Anonymous, not just for their benefit, but for mine. You know, if I'm in trouble in a jackpot and I need some help, I mean, I need people to know who I am. You know, that doesn't matter whether I'm a day sober or 50 years sober. You know, I need to be available. I need to be accessible. And certainly everybody makes their own decision related to that. But, you know, I encourage the guys I sponsor, be accessible. Let people know who you are. Because if they don't, you might get lost, you know, and not found. And so I love that letter from our co-founder because it really, you know, tells me that I'm safe in Alcoholics Anonymous to let people know who I am. And that is one of the most important things that I'll do, is to be transparent to you. Because without it, I'm doomed to failure. I'm doomed to continue to be the liar that I always was. Because I didn't lie because I was a liar. I lied because I was afraid in every single situation. You know, I found out that when I asked God to remove fear, and remove fear, that I didn't lie nearly as much. You know, I moved from outright lying to accentuating the truth. You know, add a little more to what's really there just to make yourself look better. But I mean, I cured that very quickly because my sponsor said, "Well, when you do that, you need to stop right then and admit you're a liar and move on." I mean, about the third time you have to stop in the middle of a conversation and go, "You know what, I just really lied about that. None of that was true. I made it all up." About three times in, you stop doing that. You know, because it's embarrassing. You know, so, and then, you know, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And, you know, I think when I read this initially and for a long time, I frame it in my mind as principles above your personalities. You know, because my personality is fine. I've come to learn that the principles before personalities is relative to my personality. That I'm the one that needs to be changing. You know, I'm the one that needs to, you know, be adjusting myself to the world around me instead of trying to adjust the world around me to me. You know, and I don't like that. That's no fun. You know, I'd much rather tell you what's wrong with you Because I can do that in 30 seconds. I mean, easily I can pretty much give you a list of everything that's screwed up about you in short order. Me, it takes a lot longer. I can't, it's hard to find stuff, you know. But, you know, she used to say, you know, I remember we were talking about character defects, and she said, and I don't know, my sponsor was a woman, and she was not a very pretty lady, and she had these cat glasses that sat on the end of her nose, and she had a big chain that went around the back of her neck, and she smoked a 120 Virginia Slim cigarette that always had 2 inches of ash hanging on the end of it, which always fell right in the ashtray. I never figured out how to. We were talking about the, you know, the sixth step, and she said, "You don't have any character defects." My chest puffed out, and I got bigger all of a sudden. And she said, "You don't have any character defects. You have a defective character." She just took a shot at me. She said, "Yeah, I did. You're an idiot." So, I mean, nothing governs me more than, you know, this, that I should be placing the principles above the personality. That I need to learn to pause. That I need to learn my worst character defect by far is judgment. By far. Nothing even close. You know, that I need to stop sitting in the meeting in my head going, "What in the hell is she talking about? You know, or he talking about? It had nothing to do with the topic." You know, and I'm like, and then the next 4 people that share go, "That's the best thing I've ever heard." You know, and I'm like, "What do you don't know anything. You know, you know nothing. So why don't you just sit and stop judging and listen? Because there may be a message in there that will save your life, Mr. Know-It-All." You know, and my buddy Sandy busts my balls all the time about it. You know, because he can, I don't have to say anything. He can just look at my facial expression and go, "Stop." God bless him. He's going to be here tonight for those who know him. I'm going to go pick him up. And let's see where we're at. I mean, just to wrap up, you know, if you're new in here, I hope that you will have a sponsor that highlights the importance of the traditions. I mean, the first book I got was the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The second book I got was Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. The third book I got was AA Comes of Age. They didn't let me have the 12 and 12 till I was about 3 or 4 years sober. They said, "You'll do nothing but confuse yourself with that. You know, don't even read that. It's a great book," and it is a great book. I'm not down in it at all. I love it. But as they said, the instructions for the program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not in the 12 and 12.
Absolutely.
You know, all the instructions are there. No instructions in the 12 and 12. It's a set of essays written about the experience gained in the first 12 or 13 years of working the steps of AA. So use it for that. But dig into the history of AA. I encourage you to do that. It's fascinating. I mean, I like history anyway. But the history of AA and the so-called coincidences that occurred to make this program viable and growing and thriving to the place where today it's, you know, several million people across almost 200 countries in 80 different languages, you know, and all of that is based on the shared experience of these traditions and steps in the program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, thanks, guys.